Talk about right and left convergence. It seems like in Europe, the much more efficient, they don't have two-party systems.
Yes.
What would be your opinion on, I don't know how it could change here, but the two-party system doesn't seem to be an efficient way to have a government.
You have to break it up. You've got to break up the two-party system with third and fourth parties, independent candidates at the local level. That's the first step, because they can actually get elected. Move it to the state level. Stop behaving least worst, where we settle for the least worst, and every 4 years both get worse. In Europe, the multi-party system was crucial after World War II for getting all the people in those Western European countries to have universal health insurance, 4 weeks paid vacation, better public transit, free education tuition, universities and colleges, better pensions, and better safety nets. How did they do that? Because of the leverage of smaller parties. Germany's going green because the Green Party got more than 5% of the vote. If it gets more than 5% of the vote, it gets more than 5% of the parliament. In this country, we have a winner-take-all. You get 49% of the vote and end with nothing. See, these are the practices of political paralysis. Yes?
Thank you for your talk. So, first, I wanted to announce that the Boston March Against Monsanto and Rally for Food Justice is going to be next Saturday, May 23rd.
You want to get a little closer?
Yeah, the Boston March Against Monsanto is next Saturday, May 23rd. I'm on the planning committee, and I have a lot of flyers. We're going to be marching from the State House at 1 p.m. next Saturday and having a...
This is on Monsanto?
Yes, the March
Against GMO Monsanto. Foods?
Yeah, it's against GMO
foods. Here's my introduction to the new book.
They're about that herbicide.
Yeah, this Sunday?
Saturday,
where?
In Boston, starting at the State House.
At the State House in Boston.
Yeah, and then with a rally in Copley Square at 2 o'clock, and we'll have a lot of speakers. We had 1,000 people last year.
With a rally at Copley Square?
Yes.
There's still room at Copley Square?
Yeah.
At 2 o'clock, good speakers, Saturday. Congratulations
on
doing
that. I have flyers for everyone.
Okay. Make copies of that. Send it around.
Okay. And then I had a comment about your supportive Ed Markey. I'm an anti-war activist, and I've been his constituent for a long time, and he's very pro-war, and I've had to protest him several times. In 2006, he spoke at a synagogue, and we're here on stage with the Israeli consul supporting the Israeli attack in Lebanon, and then a few years later, he did it again at an AIPAC event, accusing Iran of being a nuclear threat, which they're not. Iran doesn't have nuclear weapons. The U.S. and Israel are the nuclear threat.
Ed Markey's going with the flow of the Democratic Party, which is toward militarism.
He also claims that he's for cutting nuclear weapons, but his plan is to spend hundreds of billions of dollars of nuclear weapons, and it's only a cut because it's less than some other plans, but it's still hundreds of billions of dollars, and we should eliminate nuclear weapons.
This is what happens when you don't have competition in your district. Gerrymandered district, the Massachusetts legislature, I was told, about 60% don't even have an opponent of the major party on the other side. And Ed Markey's had it very easy. He was challenged on his second run. He asked me to come up and help him. We had a good press conference. But from there, he's never been challenged. And so he goes with the Democratic leadership in Congress. As long as they leave him alone on global warming and nuclear power and a few of these issues. And that was a very good summary. Ed Markey voted for NAFTA. He voted for WTO. So he just slices off three or four issues he likes, and he goes with the militarist and corporatist democratic flow. Hello.
Hello, Mr. Nader. First long time Nader voter, first time Nader questioner. I have a, began your talk about the extremely effective left-right divide, this Masonic, excuse me.
You got to get real close.
Okay, I see.
Pretty easy.
Thank you. You began your speech here today about the extremely effective left-right divide, and I'm not not sure who's really pulling the strings on that. That's maybe the journey of this question. You then transitioned into speaking about legislation, and in my 50 years now, I've come to realize that things have been revealed. It's you yourself, you're a master of revelation. Things that were hidden, you revealed. Like auto safety, violations of environmentalism. But now, it seems to me, I'm one of the cynical or apathetic or disenfranchised or paranoid who begins to see, well, what is the lever I can use against the national legislature? It seems bought and paid for. It seems locked up. And I'm hearing what you're saying today, but is that your soul? Is the national legislature and, of course, local government?
Yeah.
Are those the sole?
Okay, this is the most important thing I'm saying today. Less than 1% of the population can turn any powerful force around this country, Wall Street or Washington, if it represents the public sentiment. Look at the change in gay, lesbian rights. Almost before you know it, members of Congress who would never be caught supporting that civil rights have changed. You think that the activists in the gay, lesbian community are 1% of the country? They're nowhere near 1%. 1% of the country is over 3 million people. But what they did is they educated the public, and people had children who were gay, lesbian, and they saw the humanity of it, all the rest of it, right? This is true in everything. 1% is all you have to get in your community. What's the population of Lexington?
30,000?
Okay, take an issue in Lexington that you've been fighting, and you've been hitting a stone wall, and you've been really fighting. Ask yourself, if you had 300 people like you in Lexington, could you prevail if you represented majority opinion in Lexington? Of course you could. All the advances that we were making wasn't even close to 1%, but we represented the public sentiment, and we got the word out. We got the word out. That's what changed. You'll see it's changed so fast, it'll make their minds spin, because they want to stay there. They want to stay there. They want to get reelected. And they got their finger to the wind. If they see apathy and withdrawal, they'll behave according to the pounding on them by 1,500 corporations on Capitol Hill. So I want to emphasize again, it's a lot easier than we think. Historically, less than 1% of vigorous, active people turned around the women's right to vote. Civil rights movement, farmer movement, labor movement. It's never more than 1%. They talk about the Wall Street 1%, and it was Occupy Wall Street. Well, that's nice. I mean, that was fairly interesting. We're the 99%. They didn't finish the sentence. All it takes is 1% of active people. I mean, give me 3 million people in the United States. I dare you to give me one secular problem that is driving our country to the cliff that we can't turn around, including the military-industrial complex. Because we got 535 men and women in Congress. They're the ones who hold our power. Enormous power. The most powerful branch of government. They want to surrender the power to the White House like war making and so on. But they can't change the Constitution. We can hold them to it if we hold them. So that, you know, that gives you encouragement. Yeah, just bring it down to locally, take your local issue, and ask yourself, if you had 300 people really determined to make an improvement in Lexington, and the people were silently behind you. Go ahead.
Hi. So I have two questions. One is very specific, one is more general. Before I ask them, though, I do have one comment. I think there are actually quite a few corporatists who don't call themselves conservatives. You know, definitely a lot of them call themselves libertarians, and they're not libertarians. And I think you'll find a lot of people in Silicon Valley, in my own age cohort, who are definitely corporatists, but they definitely don't call themselves that. You know, you look at Facebook, you look at Google, you wipe away the, you know, friendly veneer, those people are all about private enterprise at the end of the day. So my first question is, I know you've expressed support for the basic income, and it seems to me that the version of the basic income that's receiving a lot of press attention at the moment, which is just, you know, an unconditional sum given out to every, you know, every citizen in whatever state hypothetically would institute this. If we did this in the United States today, that would cost around $4 trillion. I don't see how it's financially tenable. Whereas it seems like the negative income tax would work perfectly. And that would be much less expensive. And I wondered what your thoughts were on that. And secondly, I think it's absolutely crucial that we don't simply reduce funding to defense, but we specifically reinvigorate the anti-nuclear weapons movement, because, you know, these things are an existential threat to our life. They're completely undemocratic. They allow one state, one actor to weld all this power, to weld the bloodshed at the head of the rest of the world. I feel like there needs to be a serious reintegration of the anti-nuclear weapons movement. So I wondered what your thoughts were on both those things.
Well, the basic income was sponsored by Milton Friedman, Richard Nixon, and Daniel Moynihan when he was in the Nixon White House. They sent it to Congress, and the liberals didn't think it was enough, and the conservatives thought it was a little too much, and they deadlocked. But here we are. Richard Nixon was persuaded by Milton Friedman and Daniel P. Moynihan to basically provide a minimum income. It's called the Minimum Income Plan, as a major step to abolish poverty. They finally compromised with the Earned Income Tax Credit, which has a lot of restrictions. You have to have children and so on. So there is another move starting in this country. They call it basic income. And it's designed to replace a lot of welfare bureaucracy and paperwork and conditions and just hand it out a certain amount. Now, the Alaska Permanent Fund, based on oil royalties in Alaska, they give to every man, woman, and child in Alaska between $1,500 and $2,000 a year. So you have a family of four, you go up to $8,000. You know, that's pretty good household supplement. And that was legislated through the state legislature in Alaska. In Canada, for decades, every child of every parent in Canada, the parent would get a certain amount every month, a check for every child. Again, minimum income. And it's not nowhere near as expensive as $4 trillion. There are people who are now working it out. Scharfman is one of them. I had him on our radio program a few weeks ago. It's an interesting thing he's done. He shows how conservative philosophers supported this, as well as liberals. On the military budget, I go for a straight-out confrontation. This is a bloated, corrupt, empire military budget that is eating at the heart of our civilian economy. It's drawing some of the smartest scientists, engineers, computer specialists away from civilian technology development. That's why when New York City wanted to replace its subways, it opened it for bids. It didn't get a single bid from the U.S. It got bids from Europe, Japan, and Canada. They don't have those kinds of budgets. I'm leaving with the bookstore. This is a documentary on peace economics and the damage that the military budget is doing to our country. We think, oh, well, at least it creates jobs. $1 billion in missile defense investment doesn't create anywhere near as many jobs as repairing our public works and our infrastructure. So we got to take this whole thing apart. Eisenhower was so right. A military-industrial complex has to be fed. Soviet Union collapsed. Doesn't matter. Has to be fed. Desperately searching for enemies. Exaggerate the enemies. Go after the whole country where the enemies is. Create more enemies. Create more contracts. Create more fear. The lesson of history is all empires devour themselves, without exception. And that's what we're doing in this country. We're devouring ourselves. We're moving toward becoming a third world economy with modern technology and superior weapons.
Hi, Mr. David. Big fan. So I do listen to your radio show, and I heard about basic income. That was a great show. All your shows are Yeah, so my question is, I heard you speaking on one of the talk shows, and you said, give $100, give $100 of your time lobbying, and that would change the world, if everyone did, if so many people did that. And also, lastly, if we gave you $50, how many people would it take to have you run for president again?
Well,
I mentioned that.
Yeah, that was just a flip. I've done my bit on that, believe me. Someone else has to move against the two-party tyranny. We did win a lot of lawsuits, and we made our point, but it's like climbing a cliff with a slippery rope, because it's so rigged. You're excluded from debates, even though a majority of the people want it. It's the only way you can get to tens of millions of people on those presidential debates. The debate commission is a private corporation created and run by the two parties. On this was a proposal I made. If 1 million people devoted 100 volunteer hours a year and raised $100 and formed a powerful lobby in all congressional districts, we could have very fundamental corporate reform, dealing with corporate crime, corporate wealth. That doesn't take that much. Do any of you have any idea how many dedicated bird watchers there are? I mean, we need Congress watchers. We hardly have any. Bird watchers are deadly serious people. Up at dawn, into the marshes, the binoculars. We need Congress watchers. No one's stopping from doing that. You always have to ask yourself, when you make excuses as to why you can't take on the power structure, ask yourself the question, how far can I go before anybody starts stopping? And a lot of times you get to second base. When you're second base, guess what? You're halfway home before they start building opposition. You have some momentum. You've got some colleagues, some networks.
My question has two parts. In past elections, we've had these third parties like, you know, your Green Party and the Libertarian Party, the Constitutional Party, the Truth and Justice Party. And I suspect that most of these people in these parties would agree with these points of convergence which you just outlined for us, since they're so reasonable. And yet, they don't converge, they don't unite. They seem to stick, you know, with their own little organization and their own groups. And so my question, the first part is, what will it take to try to get some sort of a movement to get all of these little third groups united? Because we're not going to have much success unless we do. And the second part of the question is, do you see anybody looming on the horizon, including yourself, who might be able to unite all these people in these smaller parties?
Because they have such differences in addition to convergence, they won't be united. Like if you have a conservative party that's against abortion, but agrees on three issues with the Green Party, they won't be united. So you have to start from scratch and get an agenda that left-right agrees on from the get-go and won't deal with the disagreements. So you agree and then build the party behind that. And it's certainly not transformative issues that are convergent issues. Well, that's why I wrote the book. No one's ever written a book like this before. I wrote the book to open up that doorway. But you won't get these little parties other than the personality problems because they bitterly disagree on certain issues and they don't want to lock arms. Yeah, it's unfortunate. On the other hand, starting new has its advantages too.
As I mentioned to you in the parking lot before we came in,
yes,
you're my hero. And even though your name is in my will, my stepdaughter, I think, is trying to edit it or modify it. And I also want to thank you on behalf of all of us for what you've done for this country. Now, in your presentation, You mentioned regulations, good regulations. The problem with regulations is that regulators are enablers. Enablers. And the people who want to fight regulations have extraordinary lawyers working for them. Regulations don't work anymore. We've been down that path decades after decades after decades. You mentioned media without saying that the media is the lapdog of the 0.1%. So any hopes for anything from the media, I think, is extremely naive. Now, you talked about democracy, and we're all in favor of democracy. But guess what? Most people spend their life at work. And at work, there's no democracy. You do what you're told or else. Now, there is an example called Mondragon in Spain. It's the fourth largest company in Spain. Most American economists don't even know it exists. That company is owned and run by the workers. The workers decide what is to be made, how it's to be made, under what conditions it's made, and they get the profits. Now, the 0.1% that you refer to the corporatists, I think the word corporatist is extremely vague. We know the names of the 0.1%, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think 400 of them have a net worth which is equal to 50% of the world's population or something.
That's true.
Something short.
Yeah.
In Mondragon, the CEO does not earn more than 10 times what the lowest worker does. And you pointed out that here, you know, there's 300 to 400 times. What you call a left-right kind of meeting, this is an old story. It's called the United Front, where people with different ideologies gather around one issue and are focused on it. It's not that rich. New. Now, you also referred to your dad was wrong. I'm sorry. Capitalism would not be with us always. Feudalism was not with us always. Monarchy was not with us always. Slavery was not with us always. And right now, capitalism, which did bring us the good in the past, is now delivering the bad. We have 57 million on food stamps. We have 2.7 million in prisons. We have more people in prisons than China does. Now, of course, China doesn't have any black people, and maybe they shoot them. But the situation now is terrible. And if you go around the country and talk to very ordinary people, I was in a hospital recently, and I got to talk to orderlies and people. These people are just so open to new political systems that it's extraordinary. So thank you, and I hope you reflect on some of that.
Well, let me just quickly respond. I'm the first one to demonstrate there's good regulation and bad regulation. We got rid of a lot of the cartel regulation that prevented competition because you had a number of airlines, railroads, trucks, that made sure that their markets were protected by the force of the government. There's also a lot of regulation that turns bad because the corporate lawyers so overcomplicate and get waivers and extensions that if it was well-meaning, say for pollution control, becomes a monster. This is true in the healthcare regulatory area. On the other hand, there's really life-saving regulation. A lot of people are saved by auto safety standards, recall standards, food contamination standards, and so on. So I'm not across the board. The second is The media is. Ben Bandickian would write books for Beacon Press, and his first book was 57 Companies Control the Bulk of the Magazine, Newspaper, TV, Radio. Then he'd come out with another edition, and it'd be down to 30. Then he'd come out with another edition. He finally gave up and it was down to 7. Just think of that. You know, that's enormous concentration. However, that does not mean that's the only media. More and more people don't even watch that stuff. They have their social media, they have their independent media, their own personal media. And it's very easy to get information now that the networks do not touch. Very, very easy. The third, on the workplace, you've been around long enough to know that when the early industrial revolution came, the artisans and craftspeople in New England, who used to be independent, and that's why you had Mechanic Savings Bank, for example, the mechanics, they would independently contract with manufacturers. But when manufacturers started hiring a lot of employees, they sucked these people in, tried to drive them out, and they called them wage slavery. It's called, employees of factories were called wage slaves. Until a few decades ago. Regardless of the conditions or the wage, it was lack of freedom, like you point out. You have no freedom in the workplace. The Constitution stops when you walk into that factory, through that factory door. There's a lot of good work on how to deal with it. You mentioned Modrigón. The United Steelworkers signed an agreement with Modrigón to bring it here, but nothing has happened in 5 years. They wanted to, by the way, Modrigón is more than a producer co-op. It's a consumer co-op. And United Steelworks said, why not bring their experience and start consumer co-ops? The one problem with Modrigón, and by the way, it's a multi-billion-dollar machine, tools, you name it.
60,000 employees.
Right. What holds them together is the Basque ethnic group. The Basques. Who feel isolated, they would like their own nation. That is tremendous cohesion that gets people as worker owners and consumer cooperatives to put time in and make it work. Otherwise, it wouldn't work.
Have you heard of El Dorado in California? Have you heard of the Latina house workers in Brooklyn?
No, there are examples, but quantitatively, they're nowhere near Montreal. Put them all together.
But remember, capitalism started up very small.
Right. By the way, it's corporate capitalism that my father was referring to, not small business capitalism.
Yes, of course.
And corporate capitalism is on the road to perdition. I mean, they can't deliver. In the aggregate, they are destructive of the planet and destructive of democracy. They have to control the government. That's the corporate state. That's what Roosevelt called fashion. Anyway, thank you for your comments. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Mr. Nair, for speaking. That was a great conversation. And I just want to say the reason why I was late today was because I was having to defend why I wanted to come and see you speak. So I did miss the beginning, and I apologize for that, and I don't know to what extent you addressed the question of the whole issue of the existence of what you call a left versus what you call a right. And you may be aware of George Lakoff's work and things that Rob Reich has also said that are similar, which whatever people identify themselves as in terms of this so-called left-to-right spectrum, when you get down to issues, I mean, it's really, in a sense, the point of your book, and yet sort of calling it left-right is kind of reinforcing a myth that I'm not sure exists, at least in this country. I think the concepts of left and right in the United States are very different than, say, you know, France or England or something like that. So And one of the slogans of the Green Party, you see the shirt, if you want a flyer, I can give it to you, is neither left nor right, but forward. And so I see the Greens as being very much a coalition by sort of pulling away from these categories that haven't really applied in this country for a very long time. And I really appreciate your referencing history,
yeah,
you know, with respect to a lot of these issues, because I think we've been at, you know, at this sort of, that doesn't work to further discussion and only sort of sticks people in the ground instead of talking about what actually matters. So if you could speak to that issue of does, particularly in some ways, does the left exist? The right is more, I guess I would say the right is more about the fear of corporations and fear of poverty that they have instilled in us, and fear of politics.
Yeah, I think that you can always create new language, but you start with how people describe themselves. So it's people often say, I'm a liberal, I'm a conservative, I'm a libertarian, I'm a progressive. You start with that. You start with the self-identification. Later on, you know, new terminology comes up. But to get their attention and say, they're talking about me, they're talking about us, you got to use those words. Mm-hmm. And I know that in Western Europe, conservatives would be considered on many issues progressive. Like Cameron doesn't dare challenge the British Health Service. Are you kidding? He'd lose the election, hands down. But Boehner can, you know, go wild with anything similar to that. So that's why I use those words.
Okay. For people who are interested in finding out what Green Rainbow Party of Massachusetts is doing, our state convention is Saturday, May 30th in Worcester. I have some general brochures here. You can find us on Facebook, of course, because you can find everybody on Facebook. And again, I want to thank you so much for speaking.
Thank you.
Hi, Mr. Nader. I will try to be brief. I'm probably going to date myself here by going to a person in the media of the previous century. Since many people here seem to be my age or older, I like a show of hands. Who knows the name of a man named Drew Pearson? Drew Pearson, who was a national columnist, was called the scorpion of the Potomac, because he was an investigative reporter, and Collins sent about 8 congressmen to prison. Well, he spoke there at Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, my hometown, and I asked him what he thought about it. He said, ah, yes, very good. He's done a lot of things I can't do about consumers. I thought you might like to know that.
Well, I worked with him, you know, day in and day out. I slipped stuff through his door in Washington. He had a 7-day-a-week column in Washington. Mm-hmm. 7 days. The Congress feared him.
Yes. I would like to mention also, there was a librarian named Robert B. Downs who wrote several books on books that had an effect on America. And in famous American books, there were 3 books written in the 60s. In 1963-62, a woman named Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring. In 1963, a woman named Jessica Bidford wrote The American Way of Death. In 1965, you came out with Unsated and Speed. All 3 books had to do with death. I thought that was rather interesting for the nice swinging 60s, and I congratulate you for being part of that. You mentioned Eisenhower's speech on the military-industrial complex. Go look up his speech, The Cross of Iron speech. Well worth reading. And as far as conversations, I would say, go to what Voltaire said, quote, define your terms, end of quote. You tell me what you mean by the phrase, and then we'll have a conversation. Time after time, people are yelling at each other, and they have no idea what they're speaking about, and also do not assume. I would also like to say one of the things that keeps power going is an episode of the Twilight Zone called The Monsters Are New on Maple Street. Access it, see it, you'll see the point. How to maintain control. I have more things to say afterwards, but I don't want to go extend my time.
The Cross of Iron speech is online. It's April 1953, right after Eisenhower was elected, before the Newspaper Editors Association. It's the last time an American president had two columns: the cost of battleships, bombers, tanks, and what they could do in money for schools, buses, public transit, and so on. So, civilian economy. And he basically said, look, we can blow up the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union can blow us up. Is that the way we want to live? Is that the cross of iron we want? No president has ever said that since. I think he had a military background. He could speak more forthrightly. What you really have to worry about is people who've never been in the military trying to outdo their macho and aggressiveness in militaries. Clinton was like that, because he avoided the draft, and people were saying, you're going to be soft on defense. So he completely let the military budget go haywire after he had the greatest opportunity with the collapse of the Soviet Union to push for conversion, civilian economy, and redirect the money to public facilities.
To thank you for re-inspiring me. I came to the road workshop in the fall that you held.
Oh, very good.
Which was a two and a half day non-stop speech talk from Ralph, and he never repeated himself, and I think he spoke for almost 2 days straight. And just kept telling.
Well, there was a good interaction.
There was a lot of interaction.
They worked the hell out of it. 15 hours in 2 days standing up. They said I could sit down.
It was out in Roe, in Roe, Massachusetts, if you're familiar with it.
It's the Roe Center, ROWE. Yeah. You know right, James?
Yeah. Ralph just came from there today.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, so I came to that workshop feeling hopeless, unable to do anything, not knowing what to do. I've gotten sick of signing a zillion petitions and trying to, you know, joining campaigns to elect politicians, and just feeling like I wasn't getting anything done. And I just wanted to let you know that since that time, I've gone and lobbied all my local politicians, the state level politicians. I found out from them what they thought were issues that were important for us to work on in the state. I got horrified by what I heard about the criminal justice issue in the nation and our state. I've joined a number of coalitions that were working on that, and just last month I volunteered to be the League of Women Voters legislative specialist for the criminal courts and criminal justice reform. I've already gotten three bills through their legislative action committee. The board has approved one, and the other two I'm sure will be happening soon, so that we can lobby with the voice of the League of Women Voters for these issues. And I just want to let you know that it's all thanks to you motivating me and making me realize that I could make a difference.
You know, one at a time, right? One at a time. I guess that's it, huh? Should we go out and sign books? You want to get two books and give one as a gift? I won't be disappointed.